DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Coming up on this week's World in Progress, the plight of Syrian refugees in Greece, a new push to introduce contraceptives and tackle the problem of unwanted pregnancies in the Philippines.
Making contraceptives accessible to women, I think, is life-changing. For young people, this country never had any serious sexuality or reproductive health education.
And the legacy of Nobel Peace Prize laureate Albert Schweitzer.
Albert Schweitzer is someone who, even after 100 years, never really goes out of fashion. He addressed problems that these days are just as much of an issue as back then.
For that and more, stay tuned. Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. The conflict in Syria continues, and last week the number of refugees from the country passed the 1 million mark. 9 out of 10 refugees have found shelter in Syria's neighboring countries, but some have ventured a little further afield. More than 33,000 Syrians have sought shelter in Europe since the conflict began. But most arrive in a country which is going through its own turmoil, Greece. Marine Olivesi met up with a Syrian family which has just arrived on the island of Lesbos.
The Syrians are putting their shoelaces back on. The family of 16 has just been released from the police station overlooking the city of Mytilene. Local activist Efilat Soudi checks up on them.
Did you eat in the prison? Did they give you food regularly?
Bad.
Bad food. Because we are in a refugee solidarity group, mm-hmm. We try to support refugees. And how many days you stayed in?
4 days with my family.
With the kids?
With the kids.
With all these kids, they stayed 4 days. It's crazy. Eh?
But hardly a surprise. Greek authorities routinely detain undocumented migrants and refugees when they arrive. Syrians are no exception. The Syrian family hurries from the police station to the port authority and buys tickets for the overnight boat to Athens. Once on board, the kids play hide-and-seek amidst rows of empty seats. Unlike the chilly and shaky ride between Turkey and the Greek island, they quickly figured out this journey will be more recreational. The adults fall on their seats, relieved and exhausted.
The bus time is very difficult. Tired. I want to sleep 1 week, all week.
They left Istanbul a week earlier and Syria 2 months before that. Syrians of Palestinian origin, the family has lived in Damascus for 4 generations. Umnur says Palestinians were much better off in Syria than anywhere else in the Middle East.
Before, our life in Damascus is very good, thanks for God. Better than Lebanon, better than any city for Palestine. Syria is our house, our job, schools for our children, but we lost all this.
The day they lost it all was December 16, 2012. That's when rockets hit Yarmouk, the Palestinian neighborhood in Damascus, and killed one of their relatives. The attack was the first direct airstrike by the Syrian regime in this area, and it marked an ominous turn for Syria's 500,000 Palestinians. Indebted to their host country, most had tried not to get dragged into the civil war at first. But when the Free Syrian Army gained ground in Yarmouk last fall, the regime struck back, and Syrian Palestinians were forced to take sides. Hundreds fled. Umnur and her family now hopes to reach Sweden. That's the only European country, along with Germany, to grant automatic protection to Syrian refugees. They hope to get a free home and health care, things Turkey couldn't offer.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few minutes we will arrive at the port of Piraeus. Passengers are kindly requested to disembark.
The family wakes up in the port of Athens, gets off the boat, and joins the ranks of a fast-growing Syrian community here. Human Rights Watch says nearly 10,000 Syrians have entered Greece since 2011. By the end of last year, only 6 of them had been granted refugee protection in the country. Because of the odds, torturous wait and lack of benefits in the meantime, most Syrians don't even try to lodge an application. They keep their eyes on their next move, but many get stuck here. Ramzia and her five children arrived in Greece in September 2011. The Syrian uprising hadn't yet escalated into a civil war, but her husband was wanted by the regime after organizing protests. Ramzia says the army visited her one day and threatened to arrest the whole family. She fled to Turkey with her children shortly after, but didn't want to end up in a refugee camp. So they sneaked into Greece, hoping to reunite with a cousin in Austria. But the whooping price tag thwarted their plans. Getting smuggled from Greece to Italy to Austria would cost the family up to 10,000 euros. Ramzia and her children have now overstayed the deportation order by 16 months. She thought that wouldn't be a problem until her phone rang one February morning. On the line, her 17 and 18-year-old sons.
Mom, we've been arrested, they said. They told me to come and bring the document the police gave us when we entered Greece. I went there with the paper. I thought that would help, but it made it worse. The policemen started shouting. They said we extended our time here. I started crying. I explained that my husband's not here and that I need my sons. I was hoping to see a woman who'd feel sorry for me, but there were only men, and they didn't care. They told me, go, we're keeping your sons.
The next day, the Syrian Palestinian family visits Eitima, a refugee support group, and weighs the legal options. The lawyer has good and bad news. The good news is they can kickstart their asylum procedure for the family because it's considered a vulnerable case. The lawyer goes through the calendar and sets appointment dates for the 16 of them before the end of March. It might take years before getting granted asylum, but at least in the meantime, they'll be legal in Greece. The bad news, some of them might fall through the cracks.
These families have some members, children, that are over 18. We will refer them all, but we know that the police will not accept members that are over 18. Which is absurd, of course, but what can we do?
And so in that case, the sons that are over 18, what do they do? What do they have to do?
Nothing. They remain without papers.
Spiros Ridzakos says Syrians in Greece are facing the same broken system that failed thousands of Afghan and Iraqi refugees over the past decade. But that won't stop them from coming. That same day, Ayman, the oldest son of the Syrian-Palestinian family, goes back to the port of Piraeus to pick up more of his relatives who've made the exact same journey.
Six persons and 11 children.
On the train to downtown Athens, they swap stories about their odyssey.
The first boat was sinking.
Too tired.
Yeah. Before they arrived, like meters, they were all in the water.
Ayman's uncle explains the rubber boat capsized about 20 meters before reaching Lesbos. 42 refugees were on board. Everyone scrambled to the shores. Human Rights Watch says at least 82 people, including Syrians, have died in shipwrecks trying to reach Greece in September. That makes Ayman wonder if some countries, like Sweden, recognizes that Syrians are entitled to protection. Why can't they just apply at their embassy?
If they accept the refugees there, when they reach there, do they have to risk themselves to reach Sweden? That's every day I think about this, and there's no answer.
Marine Olivesi, DW, Athens.
And we're moving to the Philippines, where a controversial law is about to go into effect. It will provide free family planning services for millions of poor Filipinos. That's a huge change for this conservative and predominantly Catholic country. From Manila, Jason Strother has this report.
Just like the rest of the Philippines, the Tonsuya slum has seen its population explode over the years. In the past two decades, more than 30 million births nationwide have been recorded, and according to government stats, about 36% of births result from unplanned pregnancies. But staff inside this Tonsuya clinic are helping the community's women decide when they want to become pregnant. Each day, about 50 patients come here for one thing, free contraceptives. Patients like this young mother, Jessa. She is one of about 10% of all Filipina teenagers that UNICEF says gives birth before the age of 20.
I didn't know anything about using contraceptives or about how to get them before I had my son. And I don't want to have another baby.
This clinic and five others in Manila are run by Dr. Junice Melgar's advocacy group, Lakan. She's suggesting to another young mother that she go on the birth control implant, which will last for 3 years. Up until now, private clinics like Melgar's have been the only places in the Philippines where women and men can receive free family planning consultation. But Melgar says that's finally changing.
Making contraceptives accessible to women, I think, is life-changing because for young people, this country never had any serious sexuality or reproductive health education. We need to spend for that.
Later this month, government-subsidized condoms and other forms of birth control will be made available for millions of poor Filipinos at pharmacies and hospitals across the nation. That's thanks to the recent passage of the Reproductive Health, or RH, law. And Melgar expects that her Lakan clinics will now be able to serve even more women.
Because we deal with very poor women, that the supplies, the contraceptive supplies and other emergency medicines of government intended for poor women, that we would be able to access some of that. So there will be greater relationship between Lakan and government health centers in terms of sharing of resources.
It took over a decade to pass the RH law. That's due to its staunch opposition by the Catholic Church here and its political supporters. The Archdiocese of Manila even threatened to excommunicate the Philippines president who supported the legislation. It also called for civil unrest to block its passage. Yet some observers say the church's influence over Filipinos' morality and government is not what it used to be. Maria Lourdes Rubalita lectures in politics at the University of the Philippines in Quezon City.
The Catholic Church holds many schools in the entire country. That's where they infuse their ideas. But we can say that the schools are not anymore the sole venue or platform for information and ideas. You get it from television, you get it from the networking, and you have a lot of Western or non-Filipino ideas coming into the country.
Rebelita adds that the adoption of the family planning legislation is proof that Filipinos no longer abide so strictly to the church's doctrine. Proponents of the RH law say it will not only help control population growth, but it will also save lives. According to government figures, the number of women who die during childbirth continues to rise. As of 2011, 15 expectant mothers die each day. That's four more women than in 2009. Health advocates say close and multiple births contribute to that increase. It's the highest in Southeast Asia. But other observers aren't so sure that affordable access to contraceptives will solve the problem alone.
A law in and of itself is not going to translate to reduce maternal deaths.
Ugochi Daniels is Philippines' representative for the United Nations Population Fund. She says there's an endemic stigma about asking for birth control in the Philippines. And she says healthcare providers have been known to talk young women out of using contraceptives altogether.
At the end of the day, the interaction between the service provider and the young man or woman, or even older man or woman, is really what is going to be most crucial in ensuring that the reproductive health needs of Filipino women, men, boys and girls are actually met on the ground.
Back in the clinic, Dr. Junice Melgar and her staff are talking about the implications of the RH law. She says that doctors and pharmacists will be punished if they don't provide contraceptives to patients. But she acknowledges that is only one part of overcoming the stigma.
The women, the young people, the people who need services will be educated that they have a right, that they can claim that right. But they need to know exactly what's in the law, what they can claim, what services are there for them. The stigma has to be broken two ways, by aid, but also by the empowerment of the people that need the services.
And Melgar says her clinics will help these women know exactly what their rights are. Jason Strother, DW, Manila.
Still to come on World in Progress, a report on an inspiring blind activist in Israel and a tribute to Albert Schweitzer. But first, here's Connor Dillon with this week's development headlines.
India coal plants cause public health crisis. Indian coal power plants kill 120,000 people a year, says Greenpeace. The environmental group's report on pollution warns that the pace of India's industrialization is causing a public health crisis. Between 80 and 120,000 premature deaths are caused each year by air pollution from coal power plants, with another 20 million new asthma cases annually. The Delhi and Kolkata regions were found to be the most polluted, but other parts of the country are also affected. The study, which took data from more than 100 major power plants, says that there is only minimal regulation. Jobless Tunisian dies after setting himself on fire. An unemployed man who set himself on fire in the Tunisian capital died in the hospital on Wednesday. There are fears that the death will provoke renewed public anger against the Islamist-led government. Adel Kedri, an unemployed 27-year-old, self-immolated in the center of Tunis on Tuesday. For many Tunisians, the act brought back memories of the self-immolation of Mohamed Bouazizi. Bouazizi's death in January of 2011 led to a revolt in Tunisia that spread across the Arab world. The economic and social problems that fueled Tunisia's uprising have yet to be solved. Amnesty International says serious rights abuses continue in Iraq. 10 years after the U.S. intervention in Iraq, unfair trials and even torture are still common, says Amnesty International. The former occupying powers have also not dealt with the abuses for which they were responsible. An Amnesty report published this week concludes that 10 years after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, human rights abuses are still common.
That was Connor Dillon with the news. Over to Africa now. To Sierra Leone, a country once infamous for its civil war and blood diamonds. Today, Sierra Leone is seeing a boom in foreign direct investment. The question is whether diamonds, as well as large deposits of minerals like gold and iron ore, can be mined sustainably, protecting the environment and the people at the same time. Tamsin Ford reports from Koidu, the capital of Kono District in eastern Sierra Leone.
In front of me, Koidu Limited, the country's only commercial pit mine, looms over the city. The mountains of the diamond-bearing rocks are barely hidden by the thick 3-metre-high walls encasing the mine. Now, I'm just in a nearby village with soldiers and the mine security staff. They've evacuated the entire area for today's blast. Heavy machinery explodes the diamonds deep out of the ground, so there's a danger of falling rocks if you're too close. And with that, the soldiers take down the roadblock and people get on with the rest of their day. Koidu City is the diamond mining centre of West Africa. Two of the world's biggest diamonds were found right here, but it's also home to some of the worst fighting on the continent. During the decade-long conflict that ended in 2002, rebel factions fought for control of the diamond business here. The environment and the people were given little consideration during the struggle. Huge quantities of diamonds have been found in this region over the last 80 years, yet there are no roads, electricity only for those who can afford generators, and little or no running water. Nearly 40% of Sierra Leone's diamond exports last year came from the commercial mine, Koidu Limited, but the rest were from artisanal mines, much smaller and more informal. I approach one of the miners working in the muddy water.
Can you tell me what this is?
Yes. Yeah, this is a shaker.
A shaker?
To find a diamond.
To find a diamond. Well, have this shaker to find diamond, wash, and find diamond.
Commercial mining operations have to abide by Sierra Leone's environmental laws, protecting biodiversity, preventing pollution, and making sure people are relocated properly. However, in the artisanal mining sector, the environmental damage is the last thing on people's minds as they dig in the dirt, sometimes 6 or 7 days a week, to feed their families.
The laws are there, but they are not enforced.
most of the guys that are actually involved in this business flout most of these arrangements.
Leslie Mboka is the national chairman of the Campaign for Just Mining.
Of course, you should understand the environmental, consequences. You can still see poverty really, rearing its ugly head in these communities. So it has to be regulated.
The diamond industry is trying to develop a more ecologically sensitive approach to informal diamond mining through the Diamond Development Initiative, but there's still a long way to go. Men, women and children stand knee-deep in the fields on either side of the dusty, potholed roads. Mounds of dug-up dirt litter the landscape. With stooped backs, their eyes are down, scanning the huge shakers in their hands, hoping to spot that unmistakable sparkling of a diamond in the muddy water. 28-year-old Aboubakar Touré has been mining here for 2 years.
There is no supporter for me to continue my school. That's why I decided to be a miner.
Aboubakar gets paid 1,000 leones every morning. That's under 20 euro cents, about a quarter of a US dollar, plus one meal a day. If he finds a diamond, he has to sell it to his boss, and then he gets half of the value.
What is life like for you as a miner?
Well, that's on my own opinion. Just say, to try to manage my life up. That's why I decided to be a miner.
And you find enough money to send your daughter to school?
No, ma. For now, I'm a struggle man. I struggle to try to develop myself.
Despite its natural resources, Sierra Leone is one of the poorest countries in the world. With a growing youth population and massive unemployment, the UN estimates two-thirds of the population live on less than a euro a day here. For thousands of people like Aboubakar, digging and sifting through the dirt searching for diamonds is their only way out of poverty.
And this is a diamond?
Yes, this is a diamond.
And is this a good quality diamond?
When you put it in the water, it will shine.
But for how much money?
100,000 leones.
Salon money, yes.
So that's about 17 euros for this diamond. But it's big, the size of a grain of rice. Depending on the carat and the clarity, you could expect to pay over 1,500 euros in a shop in Europe for it. There's no doubt here in Sierra Leone, without enforcement of the regulations in the artisanal mining sector, people and the environment are left open to exploitation. Progress is happening in the country. There are new roads and electricity in the major cities. But the challenge of really transforming the country's natural resources in a sustainable way that benefits the people still remains. Tamasin Ford, DW, Nkono, Sierra Leone.
And our final story today is a tribute to an inspiring visionary. It's 100 years since Nobel Peace Prize winner Albert Schweitzer set up a small hospital in Lambarene, Gabun. This unique facility is still running today and has expanded to cater for a range of medical fields. André Leslie has this report from Marie Todeschino.
Way back in early 1913, Albert Schweitzer and his wife, Hélène, arrived in Lambarene, following a three-week trip around the West African nation of Gabon. It had been a tough trip, hot and sweaty. Lambarene is close to the equator, in the middle of a tropical rainforest. Albert Schweitzer was planning to open a hospital on the grounds of the French MEP mission station. He had even stopped his academic career to start the project. But the finances were restricted from the start, and so Schweitzer started to do his medical work from a windowless, small chicken hut. That was the very beginning. Now, 100 years later, the facility is a modern hospital. Roland Wolf is a board member at the Albert Schweitzer Hospital.
In Gabon, the Albert Schweitzer Hospital is unique. It makes an important contribution to the health service here. The patients travel from the capital, Libreville, 230 kilometers away, to get treated here.
Schweitzer was a doctor, a theologian, a philosopher, and an environmental activist. Born in 1875, he'd long held a vision of creating a village just for the treatment of the sick in Africa. Some 270 people now work at the 180-hectare hospital that he founded. The facility also includes its own workshop, apartments and a kindergarten. The hospital's medical research unit is one of the leading scientific institutions in Africa working to combat malaria. And it also serves as an important training site for African physicians and scientists too. The research is coordinated by the University of Tübingen here in Germany. More importantly, perhaps, the way that the hospital staff deal with patients is still true to Schweitzer's original vision, says Wolf.
With us, every patient is accepted and treated. That is not normal for other hospitals in Gabon, especially not the clinics. But we don't judge the sick as just being cases. We try to care for them as real people.
Albert Schweitzer saw it as important to attend to the needs of his patients personally. That's one of the reasons why now family members of the sick are also offered accommodation and cooking facilities on site if they want to stay. That the hospital on the banks of the Ogowe River still exists at all is mainly thanks to the personal determination of Schweitzer and his wife. In the First World War, the couple were detained in the former French colony and eventually sent back to Europe. As Schweitzer returned to Lambarene in 1924, his hospital had fallen apart and was completely overgrown with weeds. He had to begin again. In 1927, he started the hospital on a new site and planned it this time as a village for the sick, just as he had always dreamed of. In the following years, the hospital was continually renovated, thanks in part to help from volunteers from Europe. One of those volunteers was Siegfried Neukirch. The now 82-year-old journeyed to Gabon in 1959 and stayed for 7 years. In that time, he got to know Albert Schweitzer personally.
From the very first time that I met him, he was friendly and jolly and was open with us. He didn't differentiate between people, whether they were black or white. It was clear for him that work matters came first, but he was always prepared to listen if you had personal questions as well.
Albert Schweitzer was renowned for working hard, even in old age. During the day, he attended to his patients. In the evening, he was working on developing a new type of philosophy. Called the Reverence for Life, the philosophy was synonymous with Schweitzer's view of ethics. In short, it argues that good consists in maintaining, assisting, and enhancing life. In contrast, to destroy, to harm, or to hinder life is evil. Schweitzer's personal philosophy was always present in his work, according to Siegfried Neukirch.
I was really impressed by his aura, his discipline. Albert Schweitzer remains my greatest teacher, a wonderful friend, and a role model for my life.
Albert Schweitzer remains important still today for many Germans. According to a survey run this year by the Allensbach Institute, one in four people here rate him as one of their top three role models, beside Mother Teresa and Nelson Mandela. In Germany and across the world, clubs and charities try to keep the spirit of Schweitzer alive by continuing his humanitarian work, according to Roland Wolf.
Albert Schweitzer is someone who, even after 100 years, never really goes out of fashion. He addressed problems that these days are just as much of an issue as back then. For this reason alone, he shouldn't be forgotten.
In Lambarene, Schweitzer's wish to keep his hospital going long after his death in 1965 has been granted. This year, it turns 100 years old. These days, the hospital is financed by Gabon state funds, as well as from money from donors worldwide. Most of the doctors on site now are African. Andre Leslie, DW, Bonn.
And that wraps up this week's edition of World in Progress. Don't forget you can have another listen to these reports and find out about other globalization topics by visiting our website at dw.de/globalization. You can also download our World in Progress show as podcast. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you'll tune in again next week to World in Progress. Until then, on behalf of our Bonn studio team, Eliane Giaducci and Gerd Georgi, and me, Anke Raspa, thanks for listening and goodbye.